Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to Monday, March 27th, 2023. This is the Eastman Financial Report, and I'm your host, Dan Eastman, bringing you all of the behind-the-scenes insight into the current financial headlines. Of course, the purpose of this show is to help my viewers understand at a deeper level what they're reading and seeing in the financial news so they can better understand what's going on in the U.S. and global economy, and also better prepare and better prepare for your own economic well-being in light of all of this news. Again, we'd like to mention that this programming is brought to you commercial free, but we do have sponsors, and my excellent sponsor is Swiss America. It's a fine purveyor of precious metals in the U.S., and with a great reputation and a terrific track record. I invite all of you, if you're thinking about adding precious metals to your investment portfolio, to give them a call, 1-800-519-6271. Ask them for their free investor information, and they'll mail it out to you, and you can read it and study it and understand and perhaps make a decision whether that type of investment is right for you. I'd like to talk about some of the news today. Of course, Fridays are always bad news Fridays, but Mondays are oftentimes boring Mondays because everything that has worked its way through the weekend is finished. So we start Mondays as sort of a fresh slate every week, unless we're in the middle of a crisis and there's some layover. One thing we do have, you of course have been listening to me now for, I think this is my fourth week of broadcasting, and I guess I had the, I don't want to say good fortune, but I had the fortune of starting my show at the very same time that all of the crypto banks were collapsing, including the startup venture capital bank, Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, which is very famous by now. Of course, we all hear this in the common lexicon of the day. But it's okay, so what happened? What happened over the weekend is that SVB was merged into First Citizens Bank, and First Citizens, interestingly, is in North Carolina, which is on the east coast of the United States, and SVB is in California on the west coast. So what we have ended up seeing is that the 17 branches of SVB no longer exist. Today, when the, I guess it's only 10:30, I'm in the Midwest, I'm at the Central Time, but as California awakens to the sunshine, they will not be going to the SVB Bank. They will be going to First Citizens Bank, and all 17 branches will now have a new sign and a new lobby. When you walk in, they'll greet you, and it will be just like you have been magically morphed to North Carolina, where you'll now be banking with First Citizens. Kind of interesting, the name. I'm kind of getting a chuckle out of the name because First Citizens, when you think about some of the investors in SVB, they weren't citizens. They like poor Harry, I like to point him out from time to time. I don't think he's a citizen of the United States. Matter of fact, I think our ancestor showed his ancestors the door about 300 years ago. But anyway, it's good to know that Harry can walk into First Citizens Bank and his money is safe. I'm assuming he hasn't pulled it out and taken it back to London. That's what I would have done. But anyway, it's also an interesting name. And First Citizens is an excellent banking organization in the United States. It's well run. It's fine. But it's kind of an interesting name because when you think back to the book Animal Farm. I'm blanking on the author. I want to say Orwell. But there was a very famous line that all citizens are equal, but some citizens are more equal than others. And I think that's an interesting little twist on the name, that certainly with respect to that particular banking saga, that some citizens were more equal than others, of course, on the SVB side of the coin. And I'm sure all citizens are equal in the First Citizens going forward. But it's just kind of it caught my eye, a little bit of a smile there, thinking that as that mess was cleaned up by the United States Treasury, which means we the people, taxpayers of America, they got the FDIC bailout at 100%, while not everybody benefited from that historically since 1933. So I don't know, maybe it's a little pun on my part, but we're happy that the banking situation is stabilized. And certainly California will be well served by First Citizens Bank, because again, it's an excellent bank out of the Carolinas. And they, of course, had to step in and effectively buy what was left of the train wreck. You know, there's always risk when they do that, because I remember back in 2008 when Chase had to step in and bail out a bunch of banks, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers. They stepped in. And, you know, the amazing thing was the regulators, after the dust settled, and Chase had saved the day, they stepped in and put their balance sheet at massive, massive risk to basically prop up the system, which is what old J.P. Morgan would have done in the old days. They were still penalized by the federal regulators for all of the sins and transgressions that Bear Stearns and Lehman had done. Now, you'd think if somebody was kind enough to step in and save the world, that the regulators wouldn't be there nitpicking the next day. And that's sort of a sad commentary on how our regulatory system works, is that it's not perfect. And we certainly hope that as First Citizens steps in and basically picks up the train wreck of SVB, that the federal regulators will assist them in strengthening their operation moving forward, rather than turning around and penalizing the new owner for the sins of the old owner. So I'm going to keep an eye on that, because that was sort of a unfair travesty that happened in 2008, and it raised a lot of hackles, because the good guy comes in and saves the day, only to get penalized for the sins of the old guy, and that's not so good. So anyway, I want to move on to the next story. We have a Fed vice chair is blaming the SVB collapse on bad risk management, and Donald Trump, of course, which is just petty. But the interesting thing about this is that there's United States Senate hearing tomorrow where this Mr. Barr, there's a lot of Barrs in federal government. It must be a thing that the Barr family does for the federal government. But anyway, he's going to be testifying before the United States Senate tomorrow and explaining the whole SVB risk situation. And of course, he's saying that they didn't manage their depositor risk well, which is an interesting phenomenon, because as you can remember, the banks are basically, there's two halves to every bank. There's the depositor money going in and then the loan portfolio going out. And the loan portfolio is divided into two components, the business loans and maybe consumer loans that they make to customers, and whatever's left, they hold it in investable securities, investment grade securities, much of which is federal bonds, notes, it's a federal debt, but they also invest in like mortgage-backed securities and other types of securities. There's all sorts of creations on Wall Street, ways to package money. And I think what Mr. Barr is doing is complaining that they didn't manage this potential for very large depositors, way beyond the FDIC, $250,000, would wake up one day and go to the bank and say, give me my money. And then they have to give them the money. So how do you manage that risk? I think we talked about that a little bit on Friday with the, maybe I didn't. There's a thing going around the internet, which I saw, and it was an interesting story about effectively the way banks are set up is that when depositors come in, banks have to have vault cash. There has to be a certain amount of money in the vault. So if somebody comes in and says, "Hi, I'd like to take out $5,000 in Federal Reserve notes so I can go buy a used car," the banks have to be able to pay out the $5,000, if the customer has that much in their account. They have to be able to pay cash. And over decades, the banks will all calculate how much vault cash they need based on an algorithm and formulas and statistical analysis. So you kind of know that on any given day, maybe you're going to need $50,000 in vault cash, where people come in and they want to take out cash. And every once in a while, you get somebody walking in there and they want, for some bizarre reason, and say, "I need $250,000 in cash." Well, first of all, that raises all sorts of red flags, and the teller is going to fill out the form they send to the government, reporting you, because that's an odd amount of money. Well, when that type of thing happens, the banks will have Vault Cash, but then they also have their regional Federal Reserve Bank. And sometimes people don't quite understand that process, but effectively they can get that money from the regional bank. Like we're in Milwaukee, and if that were to happen, somebody did some transaction to buy a house for cash or something, effectively visualize somebody driving out of Chicago Federal Reserve, picking up the cash, driving back and handing it to the person. Of course, if you're in a branch bank and the branch banks are part of a network of a name bank, they would shuffle the money between branches. But somewhere along the line, they'd get the money, give it to the person, and everything would be just fine. So you have vault cash and you have this reserve ratio of basically dollars in the bank in Chicago. Well, there was a recent announcement that the reserves in the Federal Reserve banks are going to zero, and everybody thought, oh my gosh. Well, because the Fed has stepped up with this ready reserve system. So instead of, you know, running dollar bills back and forth or $100 bills, the Fed said, you know, instead of you keeping your money on deposit in Chicago, why don't you keep it in your bank, lend a little bit of it out, keep your vault cash. And if in the event something bizarre happens, like somebody needs $250,000 for, you know, to buy a house or something, we will make the reserves ready. We'll send them to you and we'll clean up later, because it's not a crisis. It's not a mess. It's just a transactional glitch that makes it a little bit more difficult. But there's mechanisms in place. It's not a bank run. It's just, you know, some guy needed a big pile of cash. So instead of having all this money scattered around these Federal Reserve and then you have to account for it every night, I said, you know what, let's just simplify it. So I read the story and it sounded like, you know, Earth was collapsing into the sun, and it doesn't quite seem that way. So I'm not so worried about reserves going to zero. I think historically they've gone from 0.5% to 3%, depending on the you know, the state of the banking situation. I think if we did see a banking crisis more serious than the one we just suffered through the last couple of weeks, go back to 2008, then all of a sudden everybody wants to have bigger reserves at the Federal Reserve, because if there is a run on the bank, you've got to have reserves somewhere. And, you know, where do banks keep their money? Well, you can lock it up in the vault, or you can park it down at the Federal Reserve. But the reality is money is digital for the most part. You know, people, you think about, you know, we think about, you know, the old dollar bill, you go into the bank and give me my money. But the reality is, you know, the money goes in, the money goes out, and, you know, we're just constantly transferring money around electronically. So it becomes easier to do that. So that was a story that I don't want to say debunk, but I think when we study the news, we have to be careful about what we're seeing and understand at a deeper level what's going on behind the curtain, because this is a very complicated situation. It's a very complex banking system that we live under, which is not good. I mean, ultimately, you start worrying about things like, you know, digital money and central bank controlled money, where you have wallets that can be turned off. That's a very serious problem. We'll talk about that in a different show. But I wanted to talk today about this cryptocurrency situation. So I'm going to shift gears now. And if this were a classroom, I'd say, are there any questions, class? And hearing none, okay, let's move on to the next topic. The big topic today that I really want to explore is this idea of cryptocurrency and the impact it's having on the banking system in the United States. It's a new thing. And there's significant concern from the regulatory perspective as to how do you deal with cryptocurrencies in the penumbra of the existing banking system. And if you remember, within the last 2 months, it was the first week of my show, when my show started, we had the Silvergate Bank that was shut down. And I thought, well, that's not common to see a bank. This is before SVB. I mean, you know, the first thing I noticed, I think, well, that's kind of odd, because banks don't shut down. So I dug into it. What does that mean? You know, they lock the door, put a chain on it? No. Here's the thing. Silvergate Bank, if you remember my lecture from weeks ago, is what they would do is, if you have dollar bills, okay, and you want to buy Bitcoin, here's my Bitcoin here. You can see that. Yeah, okay, it's not there, it's invisible. But if you want to take these and you want to exchange it for these, you need a mechanism or a place or a marketplace to do that. And that's what this Silvergate Bank was doing. They say, well, we'll take these and we'll give you these. Okay. Well, there's a real problem with that because these are tangible. Now, you know, when you think about it, I get my money out here, Fair Life Savings. We have coins which are made by the Federal Treasury. That's what their job is, to mint the coins. And we have Federal Reserve notes, which of course are manufactured by the Federal Reserve System, and you know, they're good for all debts. This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, it says. Okay, this is a bank note. This is a coin of the realm. And of course, the federal government has the power to make these in their federal mints. So if we didn't have these, and we went back to some sort of a proto-Stone Age, you would want these, okay? Because people have been using coins for a very, very long time. You know, they dig around in the Middle East and they, you know, these archaeological digs, you know, what are the first thing they find? You know, Roman coin, Greek coin, Assyrian coin, you know, whatever. There's money's important. So where I'm going with this is that when you look at what money is, there are three classic definitions by classical economists. Back when I was in graduate school studying economics, we had to memorize and regurgitate that there are three components to money. First of all, it's a medium of exchange. Okay, instead of me trading a chicken for fix the flat tire on my car, I can sell the chicken to somebody. I get money, and then I can give the money to the guy fixing my flat tire. It's a medium of exchange, so I don't have to trade or barter. Okay, it simplifies an exchange between parties. And of course, in order to do that, people have to believe that this is a store of value. So if I sell the chicken and I get the dollar, and then I give the dollar to the guy to fix my tire, I have to believe there's a store of value. The value of my chicken is stored in this piece of paper, and the guy fixing my tire, he could care less about a chicken, but he sees this dollar and says, there's a store of value because I can take this dollar and give it to somebody else. I can buy pork chops or you know, flowers for my wife, whatever. There's a store of value. That's why when people see a dollar bill blown around on the street, they'll still stop and pick it up, or a quarter, maybe. I don't know, whatever triggers you, you'll see, boy, that's a valuable thing. There's a lot of pieces, you know, like a lot of candy bar wrappers or whatever blowing around the street. But when you see one of these blowing by, you kind of go chasing after it because there's a store of value in that. Okay. The third definition is very esoteric. And this is getting to be sort of an economics lecture, but it's the unit of account. And so what does that mean? That's a lot of words. What unit of account? Okay. What this is $1, okay? It's the base of the American currency system. The almighty dollar, the American dollar, this is it. This is the one. It's right here. It's the dollar. And what it tells you is everything is denominated in a dollar, in the dollar units. So, like, if I buy a car, if I sell my car for $5,000 and I get 5,000 of these, I get 5,000 of these, and I know when I open up I stick them into the mattress, okay? A week later, I pull them all back out because I want to go buy something, store of value, and go buy something. It's $5,000. It's 5,000 pieces of paper. It's $5,000, okay? And this, it basically is the unit of exchange. Now, watch this segue. When you take a dollar, let's say you have, I don't know what gold spot price is today. Let's say it's, use a round number. Let's say it's $2,000. Okay, so I give 2,000 of these for gold. Okay, now I've got a coin that's a gold coin, and it goes up. Now it's $2,050. Well, that gold went up $50, and if I buy an antique with that, and the antique goes up, that antique is worth more than $50. Okay, if I keep the money under the mattress, when I pull it out, it's going to be, a dollar. When I pull the gold coin out, it's worth more than a dollar. It's got an intrinsic, it's got market value higher than what you paid for it. So something like gold or something like silver or something like Bitcoin, it goes up and it goes down and it goes up and it goes down depending on the demand, the supply available, and the demand by buyers. And as the price goes up and it goes down, it's still denominated in a dollar. So effectively, this unit of account is how we value everything in society. So the problem with Bitcoin is, it, you know, in the beginning, I shouldn't say Bitcoin, let me just say crypto coins, because Bitcoin is one brand, okay? But what happened is it started out cheap, and then it went up to like $60,000. And then you think, holy smokes, if I put a dollar under my mattress, I can sleep until the end of my life. And, you know, those taking care of my estate afterward will lift the mattress and it'll be $1. It's going to be $60,000 that magically appeared. So effectively what happens is we're taking a commodity. And that's what commodities do. When you price a commodity, whether it's wheat or corn or pork bellies or, you know, crypto coins, the value goes up and down in relationship to a unit of account. And that's the problem with Bitcoin. When you put, cyber coins, when you take cyber coins as a bank and you take cyber coins and you buy them with the idea of speculation, your reserves are, you're basically holding commodities. And when you look at the banking system, when they look at the set the reserves for banks so that they make sure they have enough money to reimburse the depositors, they don't have wheat, they don't have corn, they don't have soybeans, they don't have, Bitcoin or cyber coins. They probably don't have gold, and they probably don't have silver for purposes of the ratios, because the unit of account is not stable. And that's why when you go back to the Silvergate Bank and Signature Bank and even Silicon Valley Bank, when they started putting these cyber units into their reserve ratios, it's creating this pulsing valuation. And keep in mind, these banks mark to market every day. They take their assets, their loans, and they mark them to market. And if this is going like this, you have a very hard time managing risk. So banks have never really put commodities and speculative units in their reserves. And I think that's been a real big part of the problem, as how do you emerge into a financial system where, like I said, if you have, you know, let's say you have $10,000, 10,000 of these, you stuff them under the mattress, and, you know, 6 months later, you know, yeah, I got 10,000 of these under the mattress, I'm safe. They don't go up, they don't go down, it's just a dollar. The risk I have, of course, in doing that is inflation. And that has traditionally been the most fearful thing that government regulators worry about, other than bank collapses themselves. I mean, you want to keep the bank stable, but as the economy inflates, when you put the 10,000 bucks under the mattress, they're still there. And if inflation is like running at, you know, 15% a year, well, the 10,000 piece of paper is still under the mattress, but the buying power has deteriorated. But from a purpose of a unit of account, the units of account don't change. And I think that's really, it's an esoteric concept to understand, but that's the problem we're having with the regulators stepping in and saying, you know, as we move to a cryptocurrency world, you could have a cryptocurrency driven economy, but the crypto has to be stable in price. You can't have, you know, it's like my quarter here. You know, when you have a quarter, it has to be a quarter. When you have a dollar, it has to be a dollar. Now, we never buy dollar. Nobody ever goes to the bank and takes out $10,000 gambling that they're going to be worth more money next week. They're not. You take $10,000 out, it's going to be worth $10,000. The question is buying power. What can you get for the $10,000? That's the bigger question. And that's why when you try to figure out how to do a cryptocurrency world, you have the one thing you don't have. I mean, you certainly have a medium of exchange. People will buy and sell these things. You know, you want to buy a car with crypto, or you want to buy a boat with crypto, you can do it. And of course, it stores value, but you also have the speculative component. And the speculative component is what really makes that form of currency risky and suspect, because it's not just like it just keeps going up and up and up and up. It can go down. And when it goes down, you can imagine you wake up one morning, you know, and you look under the mattress and there's only 8,000 left. What happened to the other 2,000? Well, unless the bed bugs ate them, they're going to be there. But with crypto, man, you know, you wake up and you have 8,000 cryptos left. And what happened to the other 2,000? It's not a, you know, it's not that type of a unit of exchange or even a store of value that you can bank on. So this is a long economics lecture, but the reason I bring it up is because the Federal Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC is the federal agency that regulates the commodities markets. You know, wheat, soybeans, cheese, pork bellies, whatever, you know, gold, silver, anything that trades as a commodity in the American system is regulated by the CFTC. And they've been stepping in. As a matter of fact, they just sued this Binance, which is effectively a cyber coin operation, because what they're arguing, what the federal government is arguing, is that this isn't money. This is a speculative commodity. And when you have the federal government trying to shape all of these different cryptocurrencies as nothing more than a speculative contract, like a futures contract for wheat or corn or whatever, then it really raises the question, is it money or is it a speculative vehicle? And from the investor's perspective, from our perspective, there's nothing wrong with speculating in you know, commodities. I mean, that's the whole futures world is basically driven on speculation. Even in stocks, when you have options on, I don't know, on equities, it's a bet, it's a gamble. And that's how markets clear. That's how, you know, farmers can sell wheat and corn forward on a futures contract and get paid up front and then plant it and not have to wonder what the value is going to be in September, October when they harvest, because they already sold it, you know, before they put the seeds in the ground. This is a classic way of agriculture hedging. It's worked very well. I mean, there's winners and losers, but at the end of the day, everything again is denominated in US dollars. So I guess the question is, if the CFTC is successful in its lawsuit, you're going to end up in a situation where these cyber coins may not ever become currency, because throughout history, currency has been a very stable investment. And it has to be that way, because otherwise you just can't take the risk in any currency that the intrinsic value is deteriorating due to speculation. Like I said, nobody speculates on a dollar bill. You know, this is not going up tomorrow and it's not going down tomorrow. It's going to be $1. But inflation is the problem. Inflation goes up, I can buy less with my $1. So that's why I think we would really be watching as these banks, and it's very interesting to know that in the last 2 months that the Silvergate, the Signature Bank, and Silicon Valley have all been shut, because they're trying to push the envelope from the technological perspective as we migrate toward what could be some sort of a cyber currency, and the impact on the existing banking structure. And any transition has to go very slow and carefully. And the biggest problem that cyber has is that just like the federal dollar, Federal Reserve can print infinite amounts, and frankly, they have. I mean, like I think I mentioned, you know, if I hand you a dollar every second, how long before I can hand you $1 trillion? It's 31,688 years, okay? Well, the problem with cyber coins is that they have the same thing. You know, with this, they have a printing press with a dollar bill, whether it's a digital dollar or a paper dollar. But with the cyber world, you know, there's this mining concept where you burn up enough electricity, you're going to invent a coin. But what's to say the algorithms can't be changed? You can just create, you know, cyber money like uses, you know, fast and furiously as you can create Federal Reserve notes. It's all about supply and demand. And the more currency and coin in circulation, then it drives more inflation. So I think those are all concepts we want to be thinking about as we start investing. Before you do invest in anything, you want to really start to think about what am I seeing? What am I thinking about? What's the risk? And I think from the perspective of the banking system, I'm watching very carefully how cyber currency is going to play in a banking system that started out with gold and silver coins thousands of years ago, has moved through Federal Reserve notes, and digital money. Let's see how it happens. Anyway, that's all for today. I hope that's all clear and fully understood, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. But thanks for tuning in. Take care. Bye.